Hey, Billions, we're tied for Emmy nominations this year. What wasn't nominated but should win?
I'm Katie Rich. That was a really good joke. Catherine Hahn was really great on this past season, Transparent, and Melora Hardin got the guest actress nomination instead. That's wrong.
Hey, it's me, David the Seven. I think Crazy Ex-Girlfriend should be in the main awards somewhere. I don't watch it regularly, but I know pure joy when I see it.
I'm Joanna Robinson, and I would say Aya Cash for You're the Worst, which would probably be category fraud if it were in the comedy section, but I'd be for it.
Really? I thought it was a comedy, or I was supposed to be laughing. Sorry. I am Matt Patches, and I'm going to go with Maria Bamford for Lady Dynamite. Why wasn't she in the Best Actress comedy category for her maniacal laughing and crazy portrait of her own bipolar disorder? It was wonderful.
Gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room.
Fine, I can hear you now, Dimitri. Clear and plain and coming through fine. I'm coming through fine too, eh? Good. Then, as you say, we're both coming through fine. Good. Well, it's good that you're fine and I'm fine. I agree with you. It's great to be fine.
It's a podcast.
Hello, welcome to another episode of Fighting in the War Room. It's episode 136 for Tuesday, September 13th, and on this day in 1974, the Rockford Files premiered, and we're thankful for James Garner.
I wrote that, but I'm thankful for the Rockford Files.
Are you actually are thankful for the Rockford Files, or are you?
Yeah,
are you
both.
It's a true mystery.
I studied abroad in London, and me and my roommate sort of got acclimated to TV in between classes, and one of those things was the Rockford Files, so we ended up watching like a full semester's worth of Rockford Files reruns.
There was going to be a Rockford Files movie?
Yeah, starring Vince Vaughn.
Yeah.
Wow.
That would not have been good for him, because this is the rare, Rockford Files is the rare show where like James Garner, week after week, mystery after mystery, whatever, is still like a great performance. That's a hard thing to pull off. And unfortunately, even though they had David Chase writing, Rockford Files is no Murder, She Wrote.
We should have a Rockford Files Murder, She Wrote special episode.
You mean the dorkiest podcast that no one would want to listen to?
I don't know. I think there's.
I'm sad to say I don't think they crossed over, unfortunately. But Murder, She Wrote did have a few crossovers, but Rockford Files wasn't one of them. Sad, but not sad like our reviews.
Oh,
I don't think they're that sad. Actually, everybody left 5 stars like they were supposed to.
Good, good, good. Yes, this is a part of the episode where we're going to read some reviews from the listeners. And Dave, you're going to read them.
Yep. All right. Let's see if they actually are 5 stars in content. Our first is from Villette3606, and it's called Came for the Joanna Robinson, Stayed Because It Is Great. I first found this podcast when Joanna Robinson was guesting. Love her commentary always, and it's great every time she stops by. Wonderful as the core cast is, and I am so glad I did. Goodness knows there are a lot of pop culture panels / commentary podcasts out there, but not all of them are as consistently charming, insightful, and thought-provoking as this one. I appreciate the diverse range of different perspectives, the sharp but never mean debates, and the interesting questions the panel always raises and discusses. And while there are some predominantly male pop culture podcasts that take on a bro-y tone, Fitware never does, bless them. There is a consistent awareness of race, class, and gender politics, and thoughtful discussions of the same in this podcast, which this particular quote-unquote social justice warrior greatly appreciates. A consistently smart, interesting listen, and though the whole panel is great, so glad Katie is back, complete with special baby commentator.
No.
Yay, baby!
Joanne, I realize we haven't been on the same show in so long, and I've heard all of these reviews like talking about you, and I haven't heard them with you listening, and I hope that you're okay with it, because so many people like you so much.
The people like you so much, and when you were gone, everyone was like, where's Katie? Bring Katie back. So
so really, when they have one of us, they just want the other one.
Right, that's, exactly.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
At least they want.
Yeah, that's true.
Speaking of our absent member being praised, the next review is called I Hate the Review Segment. But it is, the content says David Ehrlich is our God, and it's 5 stars. So, I mean, I guess that feels contradictory because...
Yeah, I'm feeling a lot of emotions. Right
yeah.
Now.
And our final review is titled Love You All! ! By Holly_Ama. Hi, I've been feeling guilty about not leaving a review yet. I've listened to this podcast since the Op Kino days.
Wow.
Yeah, it was a long time. Your good-hearted bickering has been a constant through some big changes in my life, including my move from the UK to the US 2.5 years ago. I currently live in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Ooh, my brother lives near there. With my wonderful American husband. Oh, well, my brother's gay. I guess I just brief hope.
You're going to try to set them up.
No matchmaking via the review segment this week.
I look forward to listening to you every week. I can't get to the cinema as much as I would like anymore due to work and life getting in the way. When I do get time, I use your recommendations to make sure I see something I will enjoy. Anyway, you are all wonderful, and it's been a pleasure listening to you all these years. Keep up the good work. Also, David, I finally saw Carol, and it was everything I could have wanted.
Wow.
Aww.
I hope David listens to this.
That was a touching review.
Yeah. It was
a touching review.
And to all the listeners who don't get to the movies as much as they wish they would, I'm about to be you, because I'm going to have a really hard time seeing a movie because you can't bring babies there. So, you know, we're going to be in the same boat. So stick around.
Maybe we should, yeah.
I was so happy last week when you told the story about bringing your baby into a movie, because my friend who has a baby was like, Katie, who follows you on Instagram for whatever reason, because you're a delight, was like, Katie took a baby into a movie theater. I was like, no, that didn't happen. She's like, yeah, she definitely took a baby. I was like, that never happened. Katie would never do that. You did.
It was specifically encouraged. That's the only reason I did it. And what bums me out is those screenings happen like Tuesdays at 4, so I can't go anymore once I'm back to work. So I have to really take advantage of it now.
They need an all-baby theater.
Oh my God. Well, the Nighthawk opening up in Park Slope, the Brooklyn neighborhood where I live, which is full of babies. I feel like that, if anything's
going to be
an
all-baby
theater, there's going to be like one screening room dedicated to babies, and I will be there all the time.
And one for dogs, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Babies,
a hotel
babies
for dogs. A movie theater for babies. Well, we should get on with this show. Thank you to everyone who left reviews this week. And if you are like our one reviewer, you should feel guilty for not leaving a review yet. What's wrong with you? It's time. It's
harsh.
Time to go on iTunes and leave one.
Harsh but fair.
Harsh but fair. Well, on with the show. Here we go.
I am happy. I'm feeling glad I got sunshine in a bag. I'm useless, but not for long. The future is coming on.
So we have to start this conversation about Clint Eastwood by admitting that none of us saw Sully. I know why I didn't see it. I don't know why the rest of you didn't, other than lack of interest.
Time is a factor. Okay. The other factor is I was in New York when Sully landed his plane in the water, and I thought, well, I've seen this, and I don't have to stand by remake culture anymore.
You didn't literally watch the plane land.
I watched as it happened. No, I didn't. It's on YouTube.
True,
but that was the big meme circulating, right? Was someone mocked up a page of screenplay, and it's like Sully takes off, Sully lands, everyone's safe. It's a little longer than that, but that's basically it. It's like the end. So
I'm also standing with Onion critic Peter K. Rosenthal, who is protesting Sully over the discrimination against geese.
Oh, the anti-geese agenda. Okay.
Yeah, and I actually sent David Patches some graffiti from Prospect Park, Brooklyn over the weekend where it said, stop killing Jamaica Bay geese, which they started doing after Sully because the geese are what messed up the engine. Anyway, none of us saw Sully. Some of us lived it in real life. But Clint Eastwood's career is fascinating because this is his second movie in a row. Well, sorry, hang on. Jersey Boys came in the middle. No, Jersey Boys came before American Sniper.
Yep.
So this is his second movie in a row that's going to be a huge hit. American Sniper was a Best Picture nominee. It was the highest grossing film of 2014, though it opened, or 2013, 2014, though it opened in December, so no one remembers that it was such a big hit. So he's kind of in the prime of his career, which is a crazy thing to say about Clint Eastwood because he's had so many different phases of his career. But among the group of us, we all have gaps in our Clint Eastwood filmography. You know, there's many movies he's made in the last 20 years that none of us have seen. But when I go back and look, like, the one movie of his that I really love is, like, probably The Outlaw Josie Wales, which came out 40 years ago. Do we have any... Are we just the wrong demographic for Clint Eastwood? He's becoming this huge filmmaker. American Sniper was a big hit based on, quote-unquote, heartland viewers. We were all these coastal elites, except for Dave. But, you know, the general principle of people who would not be Clint Eastwood target people... Are we just in the wrong demographic, or is everyone crazy for these movies?
I don't think we're in the wrong demographic so much as Clint Eastwood's his goals seem to have shifted. Because I like his late 90s movies and even some of the early 2000s stuff. I was talking to Joanna before about Space Cowboys. a perfect movie to watch in the back of a pizzeria, apparently, according to Joanna.
Very specific, but probably accurate.
But some of the stuff that was kind of riffing on Dirty Harry, I'm thinking...
Gran Torino?
Well, not Gran Torino as much as like Blood Work, Absolute Power,
True Crime.
Some of these more like tough guy... When Clint was actually starring in the movie, Clint. Yeah, I'm good friends with him. Clint Eastwood was starring in the movie. This persona, we were still kind of craving it because it was dissolving before our eyes as we transitioned into the new millennium. But now, and this was after, you know, he had a run of awards movies. Mystic River was obviously a huge one, vying for Best Picture, and won Sean Penn an award, won Tim Robbins awards. And then Million Dollar Baby, which won Best Picture. Kind of like these... I don't know how to describe them other than airport novel movies.
That's
straight down the middle, but
nailed it. Yeah,
yeah, that's pretty good.
Either the crime or the inspiration, kind of teetering on the edge of both of those. And then Flags of Our Fathers just felt like a straight ripoff of Saving Private Ryan to me. And it was produced by Spielberg, but then it was a real nonsense. Rah-rah patriotism movie. But then you have Letters from Iwo Jima, which feels like, how did he wind up? How did the guy who went on to make J. Edgar and Jersey Boys and American Sniper and now Sully, these kind of hagiographic, I shouldn't slam Sully too much. I don't know much about it, but we know that he's, you know, turning this patriot of America into a hero, someone who saved the day.
Not turning him into a hero, celebrating. He was already a
celebrating
hero.
His heroism. Yes, he was truly, he was celebrated as a hero, and now we're going to cement him into the annals of time. But as our friend Amy Nicholson of MTV said in her review, which I thought was astute, and this is not something that I would normally kind of raise an eyebrow over, but considering the last few movies that Clint Eastwood has made, Amy called Sully a fascinating as a study of Eastwood's persecution complex, his fear that not everyone in the world adequately worships an accomplished white man. And that made me really think, because this is not necessarily a removed opinion from all of the movies that Clint Eastwood has made, but he seems to have narrowed his scope and become more patriotic. And I think of his interview in Esquire the other month, where he's talking, you know, he's back and forth on what Trump is all about and where he's going to stand politically. He seems to become more political despite his movies not necessarily being political in tone.
Oh, yeah.
Compared to something like Flags of Our Fathers and that sort of
thing. We're in a post-talking to an empty chair world. Like, Clint Eastwood is never just the artist Clint Eastwood anymore. I discovered something really that I didn't know about myself when Patches and I were talking before the episode, which is my Clint Eastwood interaction is very low. I've seen Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil, Space Cowboys, and what was my third one? Mystic River. Those are my three Clint Eastwood movies out of 38 movies that he's directed. And in terms of movies he's been in, it's still really low, with really only In the Line of Fire sticking out as one that I've watched multiple times. And I love that movie. That is also an airport book movie, but I love In the Line of Fire.
There are some good airport book movies, we should really be clear.
But
you skipped some of the most fascinating failures, basically everything he made between Letters from Iwo Jima to American Sniper, I guess, which were just, I mean, I
Changeling, voice, yeah.
Yeah, Changeling, oh, yeah. Changeling Hereafter with huge. The tsunami.
Yeah.
And Matt Damon goes to heaven. No, I can't remember. There's something involving heaven, but I don't know. Honestly don't remember.
No. He communicates with the
dead.
He's
a psychic, right? Oh. Yeah, yeah.
And we saw that movie together, Kate.
Did we really?
How dare you?
Yeah,
my memory's better. How could you forget Hereafter?
But yeah, I haven't been intentionally actively avoiding Clint Eastwood, but other than that, like jaunt in the back of a pizzeria where I watched Space Cowboys, like I really don't have a lot of Clint Eastwood memories, and he is this icon of American cinema, and it's just a big gaping black hole in my pop culture knowledge. So
I think that honestly says a lot about where he stands now in pop culture, because I think we're all a little young to really remember his heyday in the 70s and 60s with westerns. And you being, you know, involved in pop culture, but for the last decade, his movies have been, you know, if you're not having to review them, like they're skippable in a lot of ways. And I think you are more indicative of where he stands culturally than maybe the box offices.
But his movies, they haven't narrowed in scope, even though Sully, to me on paper, feels like a very small movie. And American Sniper is very odd because it's about the wartime experience and then coming home and like seeing, being, I mean, claustrophobic. Back in your home, but this wartime experience. I don't know. It should feel grand, but there's nothing grand about American Sniper. It's very suffocating. And on one hand, I guess you could say, yes, is that a concentration on character? But here's a guy who could open up the world in a movie like Play Misty for me, or contract it to where it's terrifying and, you know, a true stalker movie. Or I think about Bird, the 1988 biopic that he directed about Charlie Bird Parker with Forest Whitaker. That is like a very stylish movie. It's not a great movie, actually. It's, you know, inhibited by kind of playing, pun intended, the same note over and over and over again. But again, there's scope to this movie, and there is a concentration on character that doesn't need to feel stilted by hagiography. I guess that's the word that I'm kind of leaning towards. And even in something like Jersey Boys, which is not based on a true story, it's so, this music is exalted.
Wait,
what happened to this?
What?
This is so pure.
Jersey Boys is based on a true story.
Is it based on, oh wait, yes, it's Frankie Valli.
Yeah.
What am I talking about? It doesn't feel real at all. I think that's the problem too. It doesn't feel real. Like J. Edgar, Jersey Boys, American Sniper, or Invictus. These movies don't feel real because of this like weird bleach bypass chrome aesthetic that he has, and the way that he started composing music for himself and putting these guys on pedestals. It's so weird. And, you know, in a movie like Space Cowboys, totally pleasurable because not real, but also they're just guys. They're normal people, and it can bring us down to earth.
I think a part,
again, a pun.
I think a part of it for me is you know, my sister and I worked really hard when we were growing up to watch, we wanted to watch all the movies, all the old movies that we were not born for and that sort of thing. We had a hard bias against Westerns, the genre of Western. And like, I've come around to the Western genre a bit. These days, I will talk about modern Westerns that I love, but I never went back and watched the old spaghetti Westerns. And then to a certain degree, Clint Eastwood, even when he's not making a Western, often he's making a Western. And so there is just that vibe of the gunslinger vibe, or the like exulting, praising a white man vibe that, yeah, just doesn't, that it was never built into my understanding of what makes a great movie. So.
Yeah, that's why Letters from Iwo Jima is so fascinating and like probably one of my favorite movies of that decade. I just absolutely loved it. You know, it's written by Iris Yamashita. So Clint is not, you know, he's getting someone Japanese to write this. She's not written another screenplay. That's curious. But, and it was going to be, I think it was supposed to be like a double feature at first. But they decided to break it up and release them as two separate films. But just like a tremendous shift of perspective. And I almost wonder if Ken Watanabe, left to his own devices because Clint Eastwood cannot speak Japanese, gives a better performance than he would have in the hands of Clint Eastwood. I have no idea how Clint Eastwood is a director. You know, he's notorious for doing two takes and being done.
Oh.
Like he gets his top priority is getting his crew in and getting his crew out. That's the only thing
he
really
finishes on time and under budget.
Yep, exactly. So I do wonder if kind of like left to their own devices, if this movie kind of just blossomed on its own and Clint was there to kind of oversee it all, because it certainly has his shine, but it doesn't have like a cementing feeling to it. It feels a little more reckless, and it feels a little more removed, and in a good way. And I think that's interesting. But
should we say something really quickly about, I mean, Sully did super well at the box office, but it didn't have a lot of competition this weekend at all, right?
No, yeah. It may not soar another weekend.
I mean, Don't Breathe is in its third weekend, and even that is like, you know, nothing with a lot of muscle to go up against it, so.
But at the same time, making that kind of money on a movie that's about, you know, about grown-ups and starring Tom Hanks and, you know, has a predetermined ending, that's still pretty impressive.
Yeah. I do have to say, I went back to my parents' house this weekend and saw a lot of their friends at a little party. And let me tell you, taking the pulse, everyone was angry that I hadn't seen Sully. This is a movie they must see, I was told. And they couldn't believe I hadn't seen Sully. And I think that's really interesting. You know, the biggest complaint out there right now is, where are the movies for the adults? Well, it's Sully.
Yeah,
and maybe
yeah.
Clint Eastwood is the auteur of, I don't know, stodgy, straight down the middle, you know, recalling history.
You're going to insult your parents' friends just like that on this podcast?
No, because I didn't mean to insult. I just think digestible is a way I'd probably put some of Clint Eastwood's movies. If I was just... if I wanted something really comfortable, Jersey Boys is there. Or if I wanted history without the rough edges, I'd probably love American Sniper or Invictus. Or if I just wanted to see Clint being Clint, you know, Gran Torino is politically just a weird movie as far as like problematic PC culture is concerned. But you know what? If I want to see Clint being Clint, that's fan service, man.
That movie
Clint gives the people what they want.
$48 million.
Gran Torino?
Yes.
Holy shit. It's the Avengers.
Yeah. It's gigantic.
Of old.
Also, Unforgiven made $100 million in 92 money, which is also really impressive.
Wow.
He connects with the people of this country.
Weird.
We're in the bubble. We don't get it.
Take off the lid and there you are. You're my king.
Hey, Katie.
Yeah.
Well, on our little planning document, it just says something Katie watched. And I imagine it's not just watching a child realize that, you know, it's sentient, which is what I would watch all the time.
He's doing a lot of staring at his feet lately, though, which is really funny because he's very interested in what they do. So I've been watching a bunch of movies. I think I talked last week about how I'd mostly been watching television because my brain wasn't working. But as I kind of prepare to go back to work and get back into Oscar season and thinking about my favorite movies of the year and really feel like I need to catch up. I'm taking advantage of this time. And I watched a combination of movies that made me think this is the year of the adolescent boy. And Joanna, I think you know where I'm going with this because I saw one of your favorite movies, Hunt for the Wilder People.
Yay!
Which is super charming, directed by Taika Waititi. Is that how you say his name? He's from New Zealand. He's directing the next Thor movie, which should have a lot of people excited. And it's this kind of adventure movie about this troubled teen who winds up in the woods with his foster dad, played by Sam Neill, who's incredible. So I watched that right around the same time as Morris from America, which I think I talked about last week, and Sing Street, which I also talked about last week, and then Little Men, which is the Iris Sachs movie that I had not seen as of last week. Have you guys talked about Little Men at all?
No, we haven't, but I'm swooning already.
Yeah. So this is a movie about a friendship between two adolescent boys living in Brooklyn. And it's just this combination of these four movies. They all star boys who are around 13 years old. It's not a teenage boy movie the way that we kind of derisively talk about movies being for teenage boys. It's not about explosions or, you know, overly sexual or anything like that. It's just...
Or beating people up.
It's just really charming. They're all really charming and heartfelt and thoughtful about the weird feelings you have as an adolescent. And they have all these kid performances that are incredible. I saw all of these movies except for Little Men via iTunes and VOD. So all of these are very accessible. And I recommend all four of them in concert.
Little Men must be coming to VOD soon. It
probably
did not play in New York very long, I don't think. It might still be in theaters.
It's still in theaters.
I saw Hunt for the Wilder People for the third time instead of seeing Sully for the first time.
Can you talk about why you love that movie? I mean, I really do too, and it's
part of it.
It's pretty straightforward. I don't think it's reinventing the wheel or anything. It's just super charming.
I think what Taika Waititi has honed, because you know he also did What We Do in the Shadows, Eagle vs. Shark, Boy. These are all great, great films that he's done. But I think he's really honed in this movie on a blend of, you know, pathos, emotion, and humor. Like, just when you think it's getting too heavy, something hilarious happens and you're laughing, and you're never laughing or crying for too long. And that's the stupidest review in the book. Like, made me laugh, made me cry, but it did. I literally laughed and cried in the theater. I saw it.
Just to clarify, Waititi directed Eagle versus Shark and Boy. Two separate films, not Eagle vs. Shark Boy.
Oh my God, but I would watch Eagle vs. Shark Boy.
Shark Boy and Lava Girl.
I feel like
it all kind of ran together there. I just wanted to clarify.
I feel like Boy, I love Boy, but Boy is a similar story about, like, you know, young men needing father figures and all sort of stuff like that. And I feel like this is him refining that story that he was telling in Boy. This is based on a very famous New Zealand book. Hunt for the Wilder People is. I don't know how much he changed it because I haven't read the book, but it just seems to be a theme that he wants to sort of hammer on. And I think
the action is pretty cool too.
The action's great.
The movie is like Mad Max all of a sudden. And you're amazed that this really tiny, intimate movie has turned into that and done it really well.
Yeah. Yeah, so I just, and like glorious, glorious vistas of the bush in New Zealand. So it's just, yeah, it's a great, I love Taika Waititi. I think he's a treasure. I hope that Marvel doesn't round his edges off in any way. If you don't follow him already on Twitter, you should. If you don't, if you don't watch What We Do in the Shadows or Hunt for the Wilder People, you should, and get on board and get excited for a Thor movie, which I should, I would never say because I hate Thor. So
Taika Waititi makes Marvel fans tolerable again by retweeting them and giving them pithy answers. It's so fun.
Yeah, Joanna, I like the tweet of his that you sent to me where he, I think he was tweeting at James Gunn and being like, do I have to have a ship hovering over a city killing people? Is that how it works in these movies?
He's
like, he gets it.
He's like, it was about the Infinity Gauntlet because like, I know you hate talking about that. He's like, what's that glove thingy? Do I have to have that? Like, yeah. So good.
I don't know if the movie could even live up to the
to his tweets.
Like lampooning of the Marvel tropes.
The first taste we got is that short that they put up at Comic-Con, which has been released with the Captain America Civil War DVD, which is just like a mockumentary about what Thor did while Captain America Civil War was happening, and it's just it's so funny, and it's got more Infinity Stone burns, and it's just, it's great. So
I do think the Thor movies usually have the best potential for humor, so that's really exciting. Sorry, what were you gonna say?
I was just gonna say, wrap up by giving Little Men one more shout out and explaining why it's wonderful, because I feel like this is so easily overlooked because there is no strong hook to this movie.
Yeah.
And on paper, it sounds like New York, Brooklyn drivel.
Yeah, it's really not like that because it's honestly about gentrification and the way that like Brooklyn is turning into a neighborhood that's not amenable to people. But it's just this really like intimately observed story about, you know, this friendship between these two kids, one of whom is like transplanted from the Upper East Side to this working class neighborhood in Brooklyn, and one of whom is the son of a... It's overly complicated to explain. They develop this friendship, and then their parents and the way that their parents are dealing with this real estate drama kind of starts to infringe on their relationship. And it's, you know, it just makes you think about childhood and the way that kids and parents interact, and, you know, me raising a kid, like thinking about how you know, treat them with respect and how you let them grow up. And it, I don't know, there's just a lot of thoughts that it brings up in a very deceptively simple story.
And there is an, like, the scene to end all scenes in movies this year. It has the best scene of any movie.
Wow.
The
best scene of any movie of all movies.
The scene to end all movies.
What
all
scene
scenes
are you talking about?
So, one of the main kids, one of the two friends, is, like, a budding actor. Actually, the one who is the son of
the working class kid.
Yeah, the working class kid. And he's trying to get into, like, a magnet school so he can keep acting. It's this kid, Michael Barbieri. He is an unknown. This is like his first movie.
He has a phenomenal like New York accent that you didn't think existed anymore.
Oh my God. He's like a 40-year-old Staten Island guy trapped in the body of a 12-year-old. I don't understand.
He talks like a
newbie. Yes, yes. And he has this scene where he's with an acting coach in an acting class.
Oh, that scene.
What are they screaming at each other? Do you remember?
It's kind of questions like, I don't want to keep doing this exercise. I love this exercise. I love, like, they're kind of, I don't know. I don't actually know what the terms of the game are, but it's something about you try to get the other person to ask a question or to stop asking questions or something like that.
Yeah, and it is phenomenal. It goes on for maybe 5 minutes of them doing this exercise of different volumes and different phrases or something. It's just so, so good. And I walked out. I was talking to someone about the movie the other day, and I'm like, Michael Barbieri is a kid to watch. It's one of the best performances I've seen all year. And he's like, this is legit. This is not child actor that makes Katie angry. That she hates all children. He is legit. You know, I bet he's in like Spider-Man Homecoming right now. That's how good he is. Everyone's going to want him. And then this person turns up, he's like, no, wait, he just got cast
in
Spider-Man Homecoming.
Yeah,
he did, really?
He's in Spider-Man High School.
Homecoming.
Yeah, he's in Spider-Man High School, and he's also in Dark Tower.
Everyone good is going to be in that movie.
Yeah.
Everyone.
And he's got the best New York accent for a Spider-Man movie. That's so... I did not know that. That's wonderful.
It's going to be perfect.
And I would say that non-kid actor thing for all the kids in all the movies that I have mentioned, they are all wonderfully authentic and not overly practiced. Huh. And hopefully none of them will get nominated for Oscars and all just have great careers. Uh, So as everybody knows, I've been in a bunker. I have not been paying too much attention to culture. And I know that the Emmys are coming up on Sunday, but I don't know a ton about them. And I will watch them because I love award shows. But Joanna, what's going to happen to this year's Emmys that we care about? Like, it's not the final season of any big show, I don't think. Like, what are we looking forward to?
A couple things. Well, the first thing to know is that the Creative Arts Emmys already happened over the weekend. And probably the most boring story going right now is the fact that Game of Thrones broke another record over the weekend for awards won. And so it's now the most decorated drama in the history of television.
Wow.
And if it wins,
which is because it wins all those technical awards.
Yeah.
Right? Like, it's winning.
Yeah.
That involved decorating the show with different panels.
And if it wins even two awards next Sunday night, it will be the most decorated show ever, beating my favorite, Frasier. Game of Thrones is winning all over the place. It's got so many nominations, a ridiculous number of nominations. But
if Game of Thrones becomes the most decorated show of all time, will you sing the Frasier theme song but replaced by Game of Thrones lyrics on this show? Do you promise to do that?
Oh, baby, I hear the dragons calling like that. Yeah.
Yes! That's the full thing, though. Okay, we have you. That's slated for next week.
Actually, wow. it should be tossed salad and dragon eggs, obviously. I'll work
on
it.
Oh, my God.
I got this.
So I think the bigger story is actually beyond Game of Thrones, which I shouldn't win any acting awards, really, because I think the strongest actors, which were Sophie Turner and Nikolai Coster-Waldau, were not nominated this year. Instead, you've got Emilia Clarke, Maisie Williams, who had sort of abysmal seasons, Kit Harington, who I just think is never very good, Peter Dinklage, who's great, but not so much this season, and Lena Headey is the only one that I would give an Emmy to.
This was definitely Kit Harington's best season.
Yeah, but that's a low, low bar.
It is.
So what we're looking at, he was acting with Sophie Turner that whole time, and she is running circles around him.
So, you know, I think what we would have to say is that what we're looking for, because, you know, we've officially left the white male anti-hero behind with Jon Hamm winning his Emmy last year. And we're looking at what the future is. A lot of people think the future is Mr. Robot. Maybe the future is now and it's Game of Thrones. Maybe the future is The Americans, which finally got nominated in the big categories, best drama, best actor, best actress in their fourth.
And Rhea Martindale won a guest actress for that, right?
Yeah, I think that's her second one that she's won for The Americans, and she won for Justified. So she's well suited. They love giving her that guest actress Emmy. But it might be that the Americans, which has just been great for four seasons, pulls out ahead this year. But I think Game of Thrones is probably going to dominate the conversation.
Patches, what are you looking forward to?
I'm looking forward to figuring out who's hosting the Emmys. Who is hosting the Emmys?
Jimmy Kimmel.
Oh, okay. Well, I like Jimmy.
How was that moment for you?
I could have Googled it, but I don't know who's listening to this and who has access to Google at this very moment. This is an important question. Why am I looking forward to it?
I'm kind of interested to see what Jimmy Kimmel does, because he gave an interview to Deadline, I think it was today, where he was talking about, he's hosted the Emmys once before, like several years ago. And when he hosted, I don't know if you guys remember this, he did this weird hoax where he told everyone watching to tweet that Tracy Morgan had collapsed on stage. This is obviously before Tracy Morgan's big accident. That Tracy Morgan had collapsed on stage to try to fool everyone on Twitter who wasn't watching into watching the show to see what happened to Tracy Morgan. And he said his hero, as far as award show hosting goes, is Gary Shandling, who would do super weird stuff. Like, Gary Shandling once blindfolded two young people, and they didn't know where they were, and he brought them out on stage and took off the blindfolds, and like, ta-da, you're at the Emmys and you're on TV. So like, that's a weird thing that Gary Shandling did, where he like kidnapped someone. So that's who Jimmy Kimmel wants to emulate. Whether or not he gets to do that level of weird, we'll have to see, but that's what he wants to do. So
yeah, I feel like Jimmy Kimmel really has to step up and be weird and be funny and be surprising, because unlike last year, which I feel like there were surprising wins for the Emmys. Maybe I'm just thinking of Taraji. Didn't Taraji win?
No, Viola.
No, Viola won.
Okay, well that was exciting. Either way,
she was the first black woman to win in that category ever, which was was exciting.
Maybe
and
that's
she,
what
and she gave
about
a killer speech.
Yeah. Oh, I love that speech. That was the like female empowerment speech.
Yeah.
Or black women seeing themselves black on women's television speech.
Yeah, you know. It was exciting. But now this year doesn't seem like it has a lot of surprises. I don't know.
Well, the two behind the scenes voting thing, if we want to get like very Little Gold Men podcast about it, is last year they opened up the voting beyond the person just in that category, beyond blue ribbon panel voting. They opened it up to everyone can vote in the Television Academy.
In every category?
In every category. So that's how we got Game of Thrones, like more populist choices last year, I think. And then this year they've changed the voting again, where instead of the year before you used to rank all the nominees 1 through 5, now you just pick your favorite and that's how you cast your ballot. So I'm curious to see how that affects the voting as well this year. I really think like for example, in the best female supporting in a drama category, you have 3 Game of Thrones actresses, and I really think they're going to cancel each other out. But then you're left with, like, I don't know, Dame Maggie Smith in Downton Abbey. Oh, like, God. I don't know.
How many times has she won at this point?
Well, what about Unreal? Is this
Constance
the time Zimmer. Where, like, is that just Buzz wins?
I mean, but Constance Zimmer has to deal with the fact that the second season tanked, and that's in the voters' minds when they cast their votes in, like, August, right? So even though she was great in the first season was really buzzy, like, the second season. I don't know if I sound really terrible insider Hollywood talking about all this stuff.
No, that's what we do
on this podcast.
we are all Hollywood insiders.
I just don't like using the word buzzy, and I regret using it. The other thing, the limited series category is going to be so boring, I think, probably, because it's just going to be People versus O.J. Simpson.
Like, I'm so excited to see all of those people take away awards. Like, yes. I love that series so much.
But if Tom Hiddleston wins, it will be the carpool karaoke over Lemonade of
Taylor Swift won't be with him, Emmys. So there's really no point in giving him an award.
Yeah. If Hiddleston, Cumberbatch, or Idris Elba win in that category that belongs to Courtney B. Vance, it will be the trial of the century again.
What if Cuba Gooding Jr. wins?
Oh my God.
That would be screwed up. He's actually the worst person in that category.
He is by far the worst person in that category. Sarah Paulson's been nominated every year since 2012, and so I think everyone thinks she's gonna win.
American Horror Story?
Yeah. American Horror Story and what, Game Change? Right? That's what it's called. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. That's right. She was Game Change.
Yeah.
She will win. She's over.
I miss Game Change.
She's going to win, but it's going to be like a great win, like really deserved, ramping up for years. This is her year sort of thing. So.
I want to talk. Can I talk about the comedy categories?
Of course.
Yes, you can.
Okay. So Modern Family obviously is clean up in this category 100 times, but there's basically every other nominee in these categories is great, and I'd be excited to see any of them win. Am I just going to be disappointed when Modern Family wins anyway?
When will this national tragedy end?
Veep won last year over Modern Family
Veep is the other one, because Julia Louis-Dreyfus has won so many times, Tony Hale has won twice. Like, if Veep wins again, that also feels a little disappointing, because
but here's the thing
stuff, but Veep is still
this
great.
Last season of Veep was incredible.
It was so good.
It's really, really funny. And it's the most laugh out loud funny.
And it's an election year, so I think people are like, we appreciate our political satire. Mm.
Like, don't you think not being LOL is working against Master of None and Transparent, especially if it's like the populist vote? Like, pick one and what made you laugh the most?
Yeah.
For sure.
And I think that I didn't mean about category fraud with You're the Worst, but it is that dramedy issue.
How could they fix this problem somehow in an imaginary Emmys? Is there a way, like, what category would you create, or how would you dissolve drama and comedy to allow for some of these other shows to prevail? Or is there pretty much no hope because only a select few of you watch them?
I don't know, Dave, what do you think?
Dave, disrupt the Emmys, please.
Yeah, I mean, I think the categories are already about as broad as you want them to be. The rest is all like playing some sort of crazy awards game, which is why we're able to, you know, analyze these things. I get the idea to, you know, do a, you know, Oscars and just be like, everything has 10 now. But I don't think that's necessarily going to lead to any of these. See, the weird thing is, like, when you have these longstanding shows that are just back season after season, I can't say that the Emmys are necessarily about people discovering new television. So, I mean, you might make some people happy in, like, the nomination sense, but I don't think you're getting, like, an overall some benefit either in award show, you know, drama, or in, like, actually, you know, making a show worth a nomination at that point.
Which, yeah, the tough thing about the Emmys, the way that television has changed so quickly, the Emmys have had an even harder time than the Oscars to keep up because the movies haven't changed as much as television has. And stuff like Master of None, there was just the Emmys 5 years ago would have, there was nothing like it at the Emmys. And it's really hard to imagine it winning just because it's so new compared to what people are used to voting for in this group.
I might disagree with you a little bit because my math might be wrong, but I think that Master of None is very much the Louis model. And when Louis showed up first, it won everything because everyone was like, "What is this?"
Really? Have I totally forgot that Louis won?
Well, it won everything at one point. I don't, maybe not in his first, definitely not in his first season, but eventually
it didn't win Best Comedy.
Didn't it not at one point? Or was it just Louis C.K.? All right, fine.
Continue.
Katie's right. I'm wrong. Well, I will say.
But like Master of None. Okay, so Transparent might be a better example, just because it's doing that dramedy thing that we were talking about.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, doesn't this just come from the erosion of what TV used to be based on, which is weird? Everybody should agree with this is advertising bait, and now we have all these different platforms and things. People are actually trying things, but they're out of the slots that were meant for. You know, not everybody's tuning in to television Friday nights with their family. They're all fucking out.
But where is the Harvey Weinstein of the Emmys? I'm thinking like, okay, Netflix, you have Master of None and Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt. Throw the money, throw the muscle around. This is your moment. You guys are the powerhouse.
Jeff Bezos needs to find his Harvey Weinstein.
Well, yeah. So what's the problem? Like, is there one? Maybe I'm overlooking something.
I'm just sidebar clarify real quick. Louis has won 2 writing Emmys and 1 for Melissa Leo as a guest actress, and that is it.
So it's actually never been.
I apologize. I overstated.
I think he won a bunch of Golden Globes.
I'm just remembering like a couple years. I thought there was a year or two.
Critics went crazy for Louis. So it was definitely like the thing for a while.
Okay.
In 2013 and 2014, it was nominated for Best Comedy or Outstanding, as the Emmys say, but not actually in its debut. Sad.
You're right that the Harvey Weinstein of the Emmys should be emerging, and hopefully someone is listening to this and will make that their very successful career.
We should point to VanityFair.com and Joanna's work.
If you go to VanityFair.com, I did a profile on John Landgraf, who's the head of FX. FX has the most Emmy nominations for any basic cable channel ever. I mean, that's a lot of qualifiers, but there you go. It's topped only by HBO because HBO has all those creative arts Emmys for Game of Thrones, but they have Fargo. So HBO,
but it has more than AMC ever got, which is significant.
Right. And so because AMC doesn't diversify in the same way that FX does. And so AMC is leaning really hard on The Walking Dead, whereas FX has Fargo, The Americans, American Horror Story, and People vs. O.J. Simpson. And so they're just like eating up the Emmy Award nominations, whether or not they take home all those prizes. They're going to take home a ton for People versus O.J. Simpson, and Landgraf has a really good sense, a good instinct for these things.
Does he want to win Emmys? Is that important?
Emmys are a metric that matter to him, yeah, definitely. He's really proud of the fact that The Americans, which is a show that should have been canceled probably in its second season because its ratings were so abysmal, is something that he stuck with, and then it got these Emmy nominations in the fourth season, which I think he feels validates his decision to just lean into it and let it go.
He probably gets credit for Louis Anderson getting a nomination for Baskets, which is a show that like so few people have talked about.
But Louis Anderson is so good.
And clearly, you know, Landgraf or the people working for him made sure it stayed on their radar.
Well, who's going to win in that category? What an amazing lineup.
It's a great lineup.
It seems like kind of a crapshoot.
Ty Burrell could win again.
Jesus.
Or Tony Hale.
I think it's going to be Tony Hale, but
that would be his third Emmy in that category.
Not enough people saw Baskets.
What will stand? I mean, you mentioned Ted. Did you say Jeff Bezos or did you say Ted Sarandos? Anyway, one of the streaming guys, right? You're like, they should find the Harvey Weinstein of television, but like, that's what's getting in. I don't know how boring this is for me to rehash my Landgraf profile, but that's what's getting in Landgraf's way. Is like he wanted Master of None, and he lost it to Netflix because Netflix had more money. So I feel like what's stopping you from having one impresario of television is that Landgraf keeps getting scooped by other networks.
Because he has actual TV money, not crazy Silicon Valley money.
Exactly.
The one thing he has is Louis, who could continue to keep making television for him, but it's just going to be too esoteric. I don't know. That'll be interesting for FX. But do you think FXX hurt them? I don't know. All speculation.
Not particularly. I mean, this is where I could step in because I have sort of been following Simpsons World's weird rise and fall since it launched, and that's through the FX app. So by proxy, I end up watching a lot of FXX programming and online things, and they seem to be doing really well for themselves. Like, you know, interfaces are slimming, programming doesn't have like useless chunks in the middle of the night like it used to. I think at whatever sort of sharing they're doing between programming and buying programming seems to at least be working out for some category that I fall into.
Did Landgraf talk to you about FXX at all, Joanna?
A little bit. Mostly, I think what they launched FXX in 2014 as a place for some of their weirder comedies to go. They had a lot of comedies that launched in 2014 that just died on the vine. Mm. And you're basically left with You're the Worst. Man Seeking Woman is one of them that's still around. And it's Always Sunny in Philadelphia. Oh, It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, by the way, is about to tie Ozzie and Harriet as the longest running live action comedy of all time.
Yeah, it's like a juggernaut.
And it's not slowing down as far as I
know. People talk about it all the time.
Yeah,
if I'm at a public place.
It's going to hit 14 seasons, which is Ozzie and Harriet's record. So, yeah, FX, man. It's the place to be. I think FXX, they threw a lot of things. A big regret that Landgraf says he has is that he has not been able to make late night programming work. Like, he doesn't have a Samantha Bee or a John Oliver. He tried that with Russell Brand and W. Kamau Bell. Those went over to FXX and died. So I think he just, you know, Dave, he's leaning into animation, as Dave said. You know, they have Archer. They're trying a bunch of other things late night animation-wise. So I think that's something that they're trying to do. But they also do have just a lot of great syndicated content that they can put on FXX. So, but I don't think he's quite figured out exactly what to do with it. But he's got it for whenever he figures it out.
Well, should we wrap this up by picking a few of these? I'm curious if you guys are rooting for anyone, or if you think there will be upsets, going back to my point about a lack of surprise. I want something exciting to happen. I want someone to smile and be happy they're at the Emmys. Who will win?
Oh, who will win?
Who will win?
Who do you want to win, and who will win?
Go ahead.
Oh, so I started watching Silicon Valley this year, finally, and it's so good, and I would love to see basically anything from Silicon Valley win. T.J. Miller isn't my favorite of the supporting actors, but if he won, I would consider it a victory for Zach Woods, who is the actual best person.
Well, what about... No, Thomas Middleditch is actually the best person.
No, Kumail Nanjiani.
No, Martin Starr. It's the beauty of Silicon Valley. They're all great.
He makes it work. You should know. He's the glue.
Yeah, Thomas Middleditch.
He is the glue. It's true. Thomas Middleditch can also win, and I would be happy with that.
Thomas Middleditch is exponentially funnier on like anything else I've seen him do, and so I really admire him being like the nervy straight man on Silicon Valley after seeing him.
Oh, that's a good point. It's a hard. He doesn't get any of the crazy funny stuff.
His reactions to things are pretty damn funny. I have to say, watching Thomas Middleditch watch two horses fuck is probably the funniest thing I've seen this year.
No, I agree with Kitty. It's Zach Woods. Zach Woods MVP.
Oh, Zach funny. Woods. He's the heart of the whole thing.
For me, the win that would put the biggest smile on my face, I think, is Sterling K. Brown for The People versus O.J. Simpson, because nobody knew who he was basically before that, and I just thought he was incredible in that series. And he's not talked about as much as Courtney B. Vance or John Travolta or Sarah Paulson, but I just thought he was just amazing. So
I'm looking up his category right now because it's such a weird thing with the limited series or movie. Is it tough competition, or
it's Schwimmer and Travolta? And Bokeem Woodbine and Jesse Plemons. Like, you know, it's basically FX. And I, you know, I love Plemons, but he wasn't great in Fargo. Bokeem Woodbine is amazing. But Sterling K. Brown, yeah.
I don't think Travolta will beat him, so that's a thing.
I know. I would be so depressed if Travolta did.
It sounds like people
Travolta,
in Hollywood don't actually think John Travolta is good on that show. No, he is.
He is really good on that show, but, like, I feel like it would be his star power winning over Sterling K. Brown as the up-and-comer, so.
Dave?
Let's see. I want middle bitch in lead actor comedy just to shake that up. But then... in terms of the comedy series, which I guess is the other thing that I care about, I really would just like to roll a dice that doesn't include Modern Family and Veep, and if any of those others, Black-ish, Silicon Valley, Transparent, Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, happen to pull one out, I would just be thrilled for the differentness of it all.
I really want Ellie Kemper to win. I thought she was so
I was watching
nuanced on Unbreakable.
Of The Office when she came on, because she's an NYU alum.
Oh, yeah?
But, yeah, I was rewatching some old Ellie Kemper Office episodes, and she, like, has that unique energy that, like, she obviously had since the beginning. And
she's
purest through Tina Fey, I think.
On this second season of Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, she just plays it with such sadness at times, especially in the episode where she goes away to the Poconos to try and have sex for the first time. It was so hilarious and depressing all at once, just working through this mental anguish with a smile on her face. I just thought it was really profound. And then the last episode kind of, I don't know, it's fine with the revelations of their mom and stuff, but it's just like, it's set in a weird place. Isn't it at an amusement park?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a very strange episode, but she really makes it work. She really connects, and I don't know. She has the strangest looks in her face at all times, just playing this yin-yang of happiness and sad. I don't know.
Well,
give that an award.
We were talking about how, you know, these other avenues of distribution allow for things to make more things complex. Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt and Jessica Jones are both, you know, victim stories, one's through a comic book movie and one's through a comedy. And it's really interesting to see those narratives start to get some recommendation. Although Jessica Jones won the Technical Emmy for, like, theme song, which is crazy because Crazy Ex-Girlfriend was also in there and is actually a musical.
Where is that show?
But wasn't it for opening credits design, or was it for the song?
I think it was for the song.
Okay.
Did it also win design? I thought design Daredevil was the nominee.
For that makes sense.
Because they had the drip and
they've got
the
Pepto Bismol
montage.
Yeah.
Cherry flavored.
I want the CW to step up next year, either with programming or with lobbying, one way or the other. But I find myself, like I was saying, finding joy on that channel more often than not, and I think that should be recognized somehow.
What happened to Jane the Virgin?
That's still good too, apparently.
I just started watching Jane the Virgin. But
what is Katie watching?
Hey, it only ever really took off at the Golden Globes, though, right? I don't remember it being a big Emmy.
Oh, I know that she won something. But
she won the Golden Globe.
The Golden Globe have this really excellent track record of picking great women starring in new TV shows to win Golden Globes.
Yeah, that's their favorite thing to do.
How's this? The only Emmy nominations Jane the Virgin has gotten is Outstanding Narrator.
Yes, he deserves it, though.
He's great. I would love for him to win an Emmy.
He's so great.
Well, we'll all be watching the Emmys. I will be delightedly watching them with my mom and not working. At the only award show of my entire life I won't have to work. So maybe next week we'll talk about what happened.
I'll be watching from my weird hotel room in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
I'll be watching in a daze. Maybe.
I'll be watching the clips on YouTube afterwards.
Perfect.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Breakdown, baby.
That does it for this week's Fighting in the War Room. We'll be back next week with a brand new episode. We're not going to get to review a movie this week. I know people are upset, but Snowden, we'll have to catch you on the flip side. But instead of Snowden, Dave's going to explain why Rubik's Cubes are bad or something.
No, why? No, you've seen the Snowden trailer where he hides the chip in the Rubik's Cube.
Right.
And, like, passes it through, like, the scanner and whatnot.
This is history, right? This actually happened.
I mean, sure, but, like, the way that it's, like, being tossed around and flipped in the thing and he's working on it, like, all the way up to security, it's just not how Rubik's Cube works, nor is it how people, like, allow you to cube in public. Like, I don't know.
Cube as a verb?
Hey, guys, you want to go cube?
No,
you're
just,
the
like,
cube?
Cubing.
Oh,
I used to cube on the way in the subway on the way to work.
What?
And it's, yeah. You could cube on the subway because nobody can get out of the subway and, like, they understand you're just passing your time. But, like, if I were to, like, walk down, like, a sidewalk while cubing, that's, like, rude because I'm, like, not looking where I'm going. Like, if I'm sitting down, like, a public place, cube away. But if I'm, like, slipping a chip at the last possible second into a Rubik's Cube to go through some security, just saying that's not how cubing works. Also, if you're going to do that, use a 4x4 so you don't have a hollow center.
I was about to ask what cube you used back in cubing days.
Well, I got I did the 3x3 I could do pretty easily, and then the 5x5 I could do because it's just like a giant 3x3 at some point, but the problem is the 4x4 because it doesn't have a fixed center, so you get a parity error, and the only way to do it is sort of like memorize the moves based on the pattern, and I couldn't memorize all four moves.
Dave Gonzalez, so, a beautiful mind.
This is the most fascinating thing I've ever heard.
I thought you had a story about a Rubik's Cube and making out with someone.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. So this is, like, I think the most socially acceptable, or the most success I've had with a Rubik's Cube in a social environment is I was, like, outside of a David Ehrlich party in the lower Manhattan, and everybody was, like, drinking, and I'd been, like, flirting with this girl who, like, followed me out, and I was, at that time, had a monochrome 3x3 Rubik's Cube, so it was all blacks and grays, and I would try to do it in low light, so it was more about like seeing the pattern once and then sort of not really able to be getting your bearings again. Anyway, she came out as I was like towards the end of the finishing thing, and like when it like stopped, we just like started making out, and I was like, even at the moment, at the very moment, I should have been like, time to make out, focus on your kissing, but instead I was like, I didn't know Rubik's Cubes could work this way.
In the movie version of this, where Joseph Gordon-Levitt plays you, you will solve a Rubik's Cube while making out with her.
And the movie is called Meet Cube. Or I Love Cube. Anyway, that's definitely the end of the podcast. Why don't we tell people where they can find us and our cubing websites and such.
Hey. You could find more about me that usually doesn't involve Rubik's Cubes on Twitter at DA7E, blogging at geek.com, and all of us, along with our other podcasts, at fightinginthewarroom.com.
I'm Katie Rich. I'm still basically just on Twitter for a few more weeks. I'll be back at vanityfair.com before you know it, though. And in the meantime, you can find all of us on Facebook at Fighting in the War Room, where things have been getting lively, and Patches has been doing a good job of maintaining things. So come visit.
Yeah.
I'm Joanna Robinson. You can find me in my sad, Katie-less existence over on VanityFair.com for the next couple of weeks. On Twitter at Joe Wrote This, or you can listen to Dave and me and Neil Miller talk about
Rubik's Cube.
Something on Star Wars Spoilers this week.
Bando. Cubes. I'm Matt Patches, and I'm the senior entertainment editor at Thrillist.com, and I'm on Twitter at Mr. Patches. And we are on Twitter at FITWR, where you can tweet us any of your thoughts. We usually get back to you. Someone asked us how to find certain episodes based on topic the other day, and I tried to solve that question. But we're open. We receive your messages. You can also answer this week's lightning round question, and we'll retweet it, which is...
For the Emmys, what wasn't nominated but should win?
Until next week, farewell.